This is Functional Medicine Update for August 2010, Volume 30, Number 8. This month we'll be discussing organic pollutants, type 2 diabetes, and bioenvironmental issues. Dr. Bland will update us on the topics of environmental factors influencing epigenetics, the roles of glutathione, the connection between organic pollutants and obesity, the case for obesogens, and endocrine disruptors and cancer. This month's interview is with Dr. David Jacobs, discussing his research along with collaboration with Dr. Duck-Hee Lee on type 2 diabetes, organic pollutants, and health. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the August 2010 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for August 2010. This issue, we're going to explore something that I think for most of us is one of those acknowledged important areas in understanding the etiology and management of chronic disease, but is one of those areas also that's fraught with a lot of confusion and misunderstanding and lack of specificity. I'm now talking about the environmental relationship to chronic illness. I recall an Institute for Functional Medicine symposium that occurred in Tucson, Arizona more than a decade ago when one of the world-renowned experts in the area of chemical carcinogenesis and mutagenesis, Dr. Bruce Ames, now Professor Emeritus, University of California, Berkeley, and our extraordinary researcher of the month just recently talking about the work that he's been doing in the area of long latency nutritional disorders associated with things like vitamin K deficiency. You recall this very powerful interview we had with Dr. Ames and micronutrient deficiencies and a metabolic tune-up. And in this symposium presentation that Dr. Ames gave, which made a lot of the attendees quite upset, he made the comment that environmental chemicals were a fairly small contributor, in fact, almost insignificant to the rising tide and prevalence of chronic disease and specifically cancer, and that there were many other factors that played much more principal roles in the induction of chronic disease than that of environmental chemicals. And I think the ire was expressed by many of the participants at that meeting because of the perception that the environment and the literally tens of thousands of new chemicals that have been introduced into it through the development of the age of the petrochemical synthesis that has occurred since the birthing of oil as the fuel that powers the economic engine back in the the early 20th century, that these chemicals are the root culprit of many diseases as they have gotten into our environment and become persistent and get concentrated in lipophilic tissues and ultimately adversely infect organ systems like the nervous system or the immune system, which then has regulatory signaling difficulties on all of function and produces a variety of different diseases based upon the individual's genotype. So that's a model that has been held as a presumption within the field that we share for some period of time, for which Dr. Ames's comments seem to be contradictory. When we start looking at this very complicated question about the relationship between the environment and our health, it does, however, open up some important, I think, landscape principles that we need to define before we can really understand whether these connections are real or perceived and not real. And those connections have to do with things like genetic variability and susceptibility, with the birthing of the recognition of the diversity of genomic characteristics that relate to how we respond individually to our environment, the age of molecular genetics, which is now upon us, which has really rapidly changed, dramatically changed, since Dr. Ames made his comments back more than 10 years ago, with the now Human Genome Project having been concluded and starting to look at the number of single nucleotide polymorphisms present in the human genome, now recognizing that there are over 2 million different SNPs that have been identified, and what effects they have on variability of response of an individual to their environment is only now starting to emerge. So that would be number one. Number two is the difference between what I would call a toxicological view of environmental exposures, one chemical at a time, looking for specific mutational injuries and how these exposures then induce what we consider in a traditional toxicological perspective or a toxicologist perspective, alteration in the mechanics of the cell, the hard wiring of the cell, to actually then produce disease later. Well, there are now very significant emerging thoughts that the role of chemicals taken multiple at a time at very low levels may be much more subtle on physiological function than the traditional toxicological injury model. And in fact, the analogy to this is a little bit like the analogy between looking at drug effects, pharmaceutical drug on physiology versus nutrient effects, where we say drugs hit single metabolic steps very hard, and so they have a jackhammer effect, versus nutrients that influence each step maybe very mildly, but the complex nature of modulation of systems biology by nutrients may produce a more remarkable effect over time than a drug which is influencing one step very hard and locking down that physiological function. So it's a different kind of effect. It's a systems effect versus a stepwise effect. It's a web versus a pathway effect. And that may be what we're looking at here as it relates to low-level exposure to multiple chemicals in the environment and how they influence cell signaling. In this whole question of intracellular signal transduction, how outside environmental messages get transduced into intracellular function and finally into the phenotype of the cell, is only now emerging as a more well-recognized component of biomedicine, and the tools that come out of informational science, computational biology, are allowing the large amounts of data that's required to be assessed and compiled and analyzed to evaluate systems effects to really now start to be approachable. And so we're starting to see more and more studies that are looking at systems-wide influence on function as a consequence of exposure to a complex array of different environmental signals, different environmental chemicals taken multiple at a time. So with that as a context for this discussion this month, which, by the way, I'm very excited to say will actually lop into the subsequent month in September, because we're going to follow on from our world-renowned researcher of the month this month, Dr. David Jacobs from the Division of Epidemiology and Health at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. We're going to move from Dr. Jacobs to next month to Dr. Randy Jertle, who, that name I'm sure, is familiar to many of you who have been Functional Medicine Update subscribers in the past and listeners, in that Dr. Jertle at Duke University Medical Center in the Department of Radiation Oncology was the gentleman that 2 years ago we discussed the work he had done on the agouti mouse, showing that what happens with his postdoc, Rob Waterland, when you supplemented the pregnant mouse with high levels of methylating nutrients, it was able to produce for the first time what's called a pseudo-agouti mouse, which the fur color changed. But more than that, the physiochemistry of the mouse changed. This agouti mouse, which is known to be diabetic, obese, and get heart disease and cancer, suddenly didn't get obese. And not only was its fur a different color, but it also didn't get diabetes and didn't have the same incidence of cancer, and it lived longer without changing its genes, just changing the environmental signaling of its genes through epigenetic imprinting. And we'll talk more about that, obviously, in September with Dr. Jertle. But I just wanted to alert you to the fact that this topic that we're describing, environmental modulation of intracellular signaling, will now be a kind of a two-part series starting this month with Dr. Jacobs and moving next month into a subsequent discussion with Dr. Jertle. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about what we mean by environmental signals influencing cellular phenotype. And there's probably no better example of this than that which we've been discussing in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update over the last several years, which is the role that low-level chemicals seem to be having on signaling that associates itself in the phenotype with diabetes, cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, and even obesity. And you recall that we started discussing this some time ago as it pertained to the recognition that there seemed to be some connection between persistent organic pollutants, or what are called POPs, P-O-P-s, and the association with later stage onset of metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, obesity, and later even type 2 diabetes. So this construct of correlation, epidemiological statistical correlation, was seen through an analysis that was done of the HEANS 3, the Health and Nutrition Examination Survey 3 data by Dr. Jacobs and Dr. Lee, in which they showed that there was no direct relationship between body mass index and diabetes, meaning fat people didn't correlate well with diabetes, unless you included another variable, which was elevated plasma levels within the normal range of activity of an enzyme called gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase, or GGT. Most of us know in clinical chemistry, this enzyme, GGT, is used for evaluating drug or alcohol addiction and for sobriety programs. Generally, we differentiate it from ALT and AST, the traditional liver function test enzymes, which are related to things like hepatitis and cirrhosis. GGT is more related to alcohol and drug-related functions. When we think of the name gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase, and not to get too deeply in biochemistry, but just to remind you that gamma-glutamic acid is a very unusual amino acid. It actually doesn't appear in normal protein synthesis, where we have alpha amino acids that are involved with protein synthesis and the polypeptides that we call proteins. So gamma-glutamic acid is connected to its neighbors in a different kind of configuration, a gamma linkage versus an alpha linkage. And in this case, there's really only one place where gamma-glutamic acid is seen in prevalence in human physiology, and that is in the tripeptide that we call glutathione. And gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase is an enzyme that's involved with glutathione recycling resynthesis, and therefore, in part, GGTP may have a functional significance related to the synthesis of a very important biomolecule in cellular physiology, and that is glutathione. You recall that glutathione has three general principal functions that it has in cellular physiology, and those are as a role in antioxidation, in the redox control. It's the most prevalent intracellular antioxidant in human physiology. It shuttles itself between glutathione disulfide, the oxidized form, and glutathione itself, the reduced form. There are enzymes, glutathione peroxidase, selenium-containing enzyme, and glutathione reductase that requires FADH2, which is a riboflavin-related cofactor-stimulated enzyme. So glutathione reductase and glutathione peroxidase work as a shuttle to keep glutathione in the right balance between the reduced and oxidized form. And generally, we say that the cellular milieu, we have much more reduced glutathione, or GSH, than we have of the oxidized glutathione disulfide, GSSG. And as the oxidative reductive chemistry changes in that individual's tissues or organs are under more oxidative stress, their ratio of the reduced glutathione to the oxidized glutathione goes down. So they get a reduction in the reduced and an increase in the oxidized glutathione. Now, that's one role of the glutathione molecule, establishing proper intracellular reduction oxidation, particularly in mitochondrial bioenergetic oxidative physiology. The second role of glutathione is that as a conjugating nutrient in xenobiotic detoxification, and it forms mercaptures as a consequence of phase two conjugation with glutathione S transferase as the principal detoxifying enzyme that connects then glutathione to a detoxified phase one xenobiotic to then render it in this more water-soluble mercapturate form. Now, when a glutathione molecule is used, say in a hepatocyte, for detoxification of a xenobiotic molecule, it connects itself to that transformed molecule in a covalent way, making it unavailable in the cell. In fact, it ultimately gets excreted in the bile or in the urine as a mercapturate. That depletes the glutathione stores in the cell. So a combination of oxidant stress and inflammation that requires more glutathione in the reduced form, coupled with the detoxification through mercapturate formation, can produce then a temporal insufficiency of intracellular glutathione that could have adverse effects on bioenergetics and oxidative chemistry.
The third role of glutathione is that of conjugating with the partially oxidized, enzymatically modified long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids. These could be derivatives of linoleic acid or derivatives of arachidonic acid or derivatives of eicosapentaenoic acid, omega-3 fatty acids. In terms of the formation of these oxidized derivatives and then their conjugation with glutathione, that produces molecules that we call leukotrienes, like leukotriene B4, the most pro-inflammatory molecule known in pulmonary physiology, or leukotriene D4. These leukotrienes are derived from enzymatically modified or oxidized long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids that then become conjugated through specific enzymes with glutathione. So that also removes glutathione out of the intracellular milieu as well. Now let's go back then to our discussion of glutathione as the second phase reactant, that is, as a xenobiotic detoxifying nutrient. In this particular role, as glutathione is reduced in its abundance by conjugating with an oxidized transformed pollutant molecule, or xenobiotic, or drug, it then has to be replaced, it has to be regenerated, and that is where the glutathione recycling becomes important, and where activation of inducible enzymes like gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase starts to play a role. So now you start to see a potential association. You would say, well, gee, does that mean that the higher activity levels in the plasma of GGTP in a person who's not an alcoholic or not having an abusive substance with a drug is a consequence of the body trying to accommodate by upregulating the activity of this enzyme or the abundance of this enzyme in the plasma to try to accommodate the need to get more glutathione available and to activate detoxification of things like drugs and alcohol or things like persistent organic pollutants. So could it be, going back to the observations of David Jacobs and Duck Lee, that the elevated normal levels of GGTP that are associated with those people with elevated BMI who go on to get diabetes is a surrogate marker for the fact that they're suffering from some type of metabolic poisoning from xenobiotics that is requiring their physiology to upregulate detoxification. And therefore, what we're really looking at is the connection between a xenobiotic exposure and obesity and later diabetes, meaning that diabetes does not necessarily come from obesity, but there is a metabolic disturbance that results in the outcome in the phenotype of both obesity and diabetes that happens to occur concomitantly, and that this connection then renders the person at higher risk to conditions that we say are obesity-related conditions or obesity risk-related conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and various forms of cancer. So really the effect is below that. The symptom is above that, which is obesity. Now with that in mind, that's a pretty long-winded introduction to what you're going to hear from Dr. Jacobs today in much greater detail as you hear his story unfold. What I would like to say is that there is increasing evidence that connects together these persistent organic pollutants with obesity. And in fact, these have even been given the name obesogens, O-B-E-S-O-G-E-N-S, as substances that can induce and modify the function. One of the really interesting recent papers that describes this very nicely is a paper that appeared in one of the Nature magazine journals entitled Obesity. This occurred in a June of 2010 issue, and I think the title alone gives you the sense as to the topic of the paper. The title was Obesity and Persistent Organic Pollutants, Possible Obesogenic Effect of Organochlorine Pesticides and Polychlorinated Biphenyls, or PCBs. Now, let's take this from the esoteric down to the ground level of language and understanding. What we're talking about are persistent organic fat-soluble or lipophilic toxins that at low level could accumulate in tissues and in so doing could modify physiological function in such a way as to set in motion a process that leads to obesity and to type 2 diabetes. We know that persistent organic pollutants are endocrine disrupting chemicals. They are sometimes called xenohormones. and they are associated with the development of metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes, with increasing numbers of papers in animals and in epidemiological studies in humans that seem to indicate this. Unfortunately, in humans, little is known about the role in the potential origin of obesity. However, recently this topic has come under much more exact review, looking at the correlation then between serum levels of persistent organic pollutants and the prevalence of obesity in cohorts of obese and lean adult men and women. So in this paper, they studied 98 obese and 47 lean participants aged greater than 18 years, men and women. Serum samples were analyzed for the presence of polychlorinated biphenyls and various conjugates within that family, as well as organochlorine pesticides and dichlorodiphenyldichloroethylene and beta-hexachlorocyclohexane. These are metabolites of organochlorine pesticides. And what was found is there was a significant negative correlation between BMI, waist fat, mass percentage, total and subcutaneous abdominal adipose tissue, and the serum levels of PCBs and the sum of PCBs. There was a positive correlation, however, with the BMI, waist fat, fat mass percentage, and total and subcutaneous abdominal fat with the chlorinated hydrocarbons. Also, the chlorinated hydrocarbon persistent levels in the tissue correlated significantly with HOMA scores, the homeostasis model for insulin sensitivity. And so what you see is people that have the higher levels have lowered insulin sensitivity, meaning more insulin resistance. These results suggest there is a diabetogenic effect of low-dose exposure to these persistent organic pollutants, and it's more complicated than just that of producing body fat alone, the accumulation of body fat, that there are many subtleties of this metabolic disturbance that cut across different potential disease states. I think these are very important questions. And then you say, well, does that also relate to things like Agent Orange and herbicides that were used? And then to answer that question, maybe we want to go back to Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and start looking at now people 50 years downstream from the experience from the Vietnam War with the use of defoliants and ask, is there any evidence of increasing prevalence of diabetes? Now, in Cambodia, as you probably know, the population works very hard. It's still reasonably non-industrialized. There's still a lot of family agriculture to produce the foods of need. And the people are generally very lean. We don't see central adiposity. We don't see obesity. So you might say, well, we would expect them to see very low prevalence of type 2 diabetes because it just is not seen in very lean, highly active people. Yet there's a rising epidemic of type 2 diabetes in Cambodia. And people have scratched their head and said, well, why? I don't understand it. It doesn't follow with our traditional identification of risk factors for diabetes. These people are lean, they're hard acting, they're eating principally vegetarian diets. They don't have McDonald's on the street corners. So what's going on? The variable could be that of exposure and accumulation of these fat-soluble biocides. And in fact, there are now papers that are being published in individuals and population groups that have been exposed to these defoliant materials, including U.S. veterans that were exposed during the Vietnam War to Agent Orange, showing how their levels in fat tissue of these POPs, these persistent organic pollutants, were correlated with a variety of chronic diseases, including type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, as well as neurological conditions and other problems, including potentially cancer. But that there is more and more evidence that these POPs really play roles in inducing metabolic disturbances that result in mitochondrial poisoning and alteration in bioenergetics and accumulation of body fat and having a neuroendocrine effect as endocrine disruptors. Well, the data confirm then the lifelong accumulation of POP does occur in the human body, and as we are exposed, these things get into our tissues and our tissue levels rise. Our steady-state plasma concentration over time then can rise in equilibrium with that of our fat-soluble levels within fat tissues. Studies have clearly demonstrated that the capability of persistent organic pollutants can accumulate in the body throughout lifespan, and there's a relationship between age and serum levels of POPs that's been observed in lean, obese, and severely obese people. In fact, Nichols, 2 years ago presented age-specific reference ranges for PCBs based on the United States Health and Nutrition Examination Survey 2001 to 2002. Now, is there a threshold where the level of these persistent organic pollutants starts triggering certain metabolic disturbances that are seen clinically? Or asking in a different way, could this be one of the factors that leads to increasing prevalence of chronic disease with age? Are these continued accumulating levels of a potpourri mixture of differing biocides that increase the relative risk then to metabolic poisoning? And when I use the word poisoning, I'm using it here very advisedly because we're not talking about traditional toxicological effects. We're talking about subtle effects on intracellular signal transduction, gene expression modulation, and ultimately effect on things like insulin signaling and inflammatory pathways and cell replication and things that are much more subtle in their influence. So I think that there is a case that's emerging to support the fact that body fat accumulation may be more than just eating luxurious calorie-rich diets, that it's also potentially associated with factors that modulate intracellular physiology, and these obesogens that are in our environment may be partially contributing. There's a very interesting article that appeared recently in Molecular Endocrinology, volume 23, page 1127, talking about the case for obesogens and how that there is now very, very significant evidence that's accumulating to say that the conventional wisdom that holds that obesity is primarily the result of a positive energy balance, meaning too many calories in and too few calories burned, is not the full explanation for the story of the rapid rising tide of obesity, not just in the United States, but elsewhere in the world. It is self-evident that fat cannot be accumulated without a higher caloric intake. However, the question is, how is calorie of foods also processed? What are the bioenergetics of its being used as fuel? And how does it ultimately get released from the body as a non-polluting form of energy, which we call heat, and water and carbon dioxide, versus stored for a rainy day that never comes? Well, that particular process is all mitigated through bioenergetics that is related to mitochondrial function. What we're saying here in this story that's emerging is that lipid accumulation may be the result of blunted metabolism, and it occurs while other things are happening at the gene expression level that are associated with rising risk to inflammatory disorders and to risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So I think that these are really dramatically frame-shifting principles that set a new stage as to how low-level substances in the environment could participate in altering metabolic function. In animal models, it appears as if this concept is correct. In fact, you can induce some of these factors that we're talking about by low-level exposure to these, quote, obesogens in the animal's environment and watching the impact it has on adipocyte size and adipocyte cellularity and adipokine profiling after exposure. And if you do DEXA scanning on these animals, you find that their intra-abdominal fat increases as a consequence of low-level exposure to these persistent organic pollutants. So I think that we're going to watch some very, very interesting expansion of this research, which may help us to understand why we're seeing such a rising tide of various chronic diseases in the developing world that we can't correlate directly with obesity. It's not like the United States case where there's a direct link between obesity and some of these metabolic disturbances. It's more of an indirect relationship. And as I've said, even in the United States, as was pointed out by Jacobs and Lee, the correlation between diabetes and obesity is only seen when focused through the lens of the GGTP level, that the person has to have an elevated normal quintile of GGTP coupled with their elevated BMI to have a strong correlation with type 2 diabetes. There's a wonderful review that just appeared in Nature Reviews of Endocrinology. Anna Soto and Carlos Schoenstein did a very nice job of reviewing the connection between endocrine disruptors and cancer incidence. Again, this is a different kind of model than that Bruce Ames was talking about at the Institute for Functional Medicine meeting over 10 years ago. In this case, we're talking about subtle effects, not mutagenic effects, but subtle effects on intracellular signal transduction, signaling that relates ultimately to gene expression patterns that associate themselves with cellular proliferation and the oncogenic process. We call this oncogenic potential or oncogenic burden. And now it's recognizing environmental endocrine disrupting chemicals, including pesticides and industrial chemicals, to have been released into the environment, have bioconcentrating effects on wildlife, and ultimately then get into our food supply and get concentrated up the food chain and ultimately delivered to humans. The effects that have been observed in animal models after exposure to these substances correlate positively with increased incidence of malformations of the male genital tract and of neoplasms, and with decreased sperm quality, both observed in the European and United States populations in independent studies. We now also see this going on to show changes in the female reproductive system and changes in neuroendocrinology, including alterations in the phenotype of behavior and obesity and prostate cancer and thyroid and cardiovascular endocrinology. These are all unequivocal and multiple study documented cause and effect relationships. In fact, even things like plasticizers, such as bisphenol A, at very low levels have been found to modulate signal transduction in such a way as to increase this endocrine-mediated pathways that increase the risk to obesity, type 2 diabetes, and other chronic diseases. So what's the impact of endocrine disruptors on endocrine targets? Do we have a specific ligand agonist understanding of how these things fit together? Because you have to get the signal from outside the cell, inside the cell. There must be some antennae sitting on the cell that picks up that signal, that environmental disruptor signal. And that is now starting to be well understood as well. There's a very nice paper that was published in Human Metabolic Research in 2010, volume 47, page 542, that looks at endocrine disruptors in human health from this structure-function relationship, how these chemicals have mimic effects on modulating receptor sites for various hormones and influencing them through signal transduction right to the genome, the production of messenger RNA and altered then ultimately proteins in the cells and altered metabolism. And there are a whole series of substances that are on the hit list of concern. Phthalate ester, as you heard about, pesticides I mentioned, dioxin, obviously, bisphenol A, diethylstilbestrol, heavy metals, including lead and cadmium, mercury, various types of polychlorinated biphenyls that I've talked about, PCBs, even things that are benzene derivatives have been demonstrated to be xenohormones, xenoestrogens, so to speak. So I think that we're starting to see heavy metals, persistent organic lipophilic toxins, secondary metabolites, and biocides all playing roles, as well as substances that are used in home products. And it ends up in things like precocious puberty and delayed puberty or fertility-related problems or structural reproductive tract abnormalities or endometriosis, mammary gland developmental problems that may associate themselves with increasing risk to breast cancer like proliferative breast problems. So these are not insignificant issues. And what we're starting to recognize is the environmental connection to our function is much more symphonic rather than hard-hitting single-agent toxicological. And the neuroendocrine targets of endocrine disruptors, as pointed out by Andrea Gore in a recent review in Hormones, Volume 9, page 16 in 2010, are the same receptor sites that modulate subtle function within the development of an organism from fetal development all the way up through adulthood, and maintain a cytostatic function, maintain homeostatic function in the organism. So the combination of all these chemicals put into our environment at low level with differing metabolic susceptibilities, different genetic uniquenesses among people, different detoxification abilities makes this area very, very complicated to study and to lock down and to demonstrate, you know, a clear cause and effect relationship. But I think as you hear Dr. David Jacobs and the work that he's doing, you're going to understand much more why this topic is rising into prominence, why we're starting to get a bead on it, a method for evaluation, how detoxification processes through enzymes like gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase and glutathione synthesis and conjugation play roles in detoxification and lowering burdens of these chemicals, and why persistent organic pollutants are being seen much more now as possible contributors to the rising tide of chronic disease, not just in the United States, But in these developing countries where you don't see the kind of anthropomorphic changes that are often associated with chronic disease in the United States, these people don't necessarily look like they're obese. They don't look like they're suffering from luxurious calories that are just causing a weighting of their physiology, but rather they're lean, they're active, they're eating fundamentally similar diets to that of their ancestors. But the variable that they're exposed to might be these persistent organic pollutants. So with that in mind, let's move to hear from the person of knowledge, one of the discoverers of this area, a person whose work I follow very carefully over the last many years with multiple publications in top-tier journals, Dr. David Jacobs.
Well, here we are once again at that section of Functional Medicine Update. I know you look forward to it like I do, and that's the experts that we really have the privilege of talking with every month, the clinicians and researchers who are really making this field of the 21st century medicine that hopefully is going to help us to address better the rising burden of chronic age-related disease and give us new ways of looking at the etiology of disease and ultimately new ways of intervening, both preventively and therapeutically. And you're not going to be disappointed this month. The clinician slash researcher this month is a person whose work I've been following very carefully and closely. Every time one of his publications comes out, I can hardly wait to read it. I think it's really creating a whole new paradigm. I've cited his work on several instances over the last few years on Functional Medicine Update. I'm speaking about Dr. David R. Jacobs. Dr. Jacobs is a Mayo Professor of Public Health, Division of Epidemiology and Community Health, University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He has what you might consider a fairly interesting background, not maybe one that you'd immediately think of as an investigator in the type 2 diabetes area, but he's a mathematician from his undergraduate training and then later a PhD in mathematical statistics at Johns Hopkins. And obviously working in epidemiology, he's a person looking at associations and has done an extraordinary amount of work in a whole variety of areas. Let me just give you kind of a thumbnail of some of the expansive areas that he's had interest in his professional career. I think where I first became familiar with his work was with regard to the work he's done on whole grains and refined grain intake and the relationship to chronic disease, some epidemiological association work that we'll touch on, I'm sure, in this interview. He's looked at inflammatory processes, oxidation, and how that relates to chronic disease. The area that we're going to be speaking to quite a bit in this interview is related to this pioneering work in type 2 diabetes, its relationship to xenobiotics and what are called persistent organic pollutants and how that translates into function. And then there's this other area which we've also talked about in Functional Medicine Update, periodontal disease and its relationship to the etiology of cardiovascular disease. So that's just a kind of a tip of the iceberg of the areas that Dr. Jacobs has been involved in, but we're going to focus in this discussion principally on this whole area of xenobiotics and its relationship to emerging understanding of its relationship to type 2 diabetes. So with that introduction, Dr. Jacobs, thanks so much for being with us. And how did an undergraduate degree in mathematics translate ultimately into looking at the epidemiology and the association between persistent organic pollutants and type 2 diabetes?
Well, thank you, Dr. Bland, for that really nice introduction. I don't know if we want to do the whole biographical course or not, but population science is basically, in a certain way, a branch of applied mathematics. It's very applied. An interesting little story is that when I was doing mathematical statistics, which is really heavy-duty math, the mathematical statisticians kind of said, well, the biostatisticians, they're just applied. You know, they don't really know the answers. But it turns out that the substance, of course, is so important. And I've striven throughout my career to really understand the substance, and I'm much more interested in the substance than in the mathematical principles. So I guess that's a short answer.
I think that's a good one. And I think one of the things that demonstrates that's been a kind of a hallmark of your work is this collaboration that you've had with Duck Lee at the Medical University in South Korea, which is looking at this xenobiotic connection and how you went back and looked at Haynes 2 and 3 data. Maybe you could take us through that whole story, because it sounds just fascinating how this whole hypothesis emerged. I'd love to know where it came from.
Okay. Actually, the story with Duck Healy is really a fun story, because I had written 3 papers with her before I met her. She's just an incredibly vigorous and bright scientist, and I got to know her through colleagues because we English speakers control the literature, for better or for worse, but I am often called on for my English language skills to help people who have written in a foreign language or have a native language other than English. So we hit it right off because I not only fixed the English, but I made a few comments on the first paper that we worked on. Ultimately, she came to Minnesota, and she's been here several times and worked with me for months to years at a time. Well, we've had a relationship in which we actually talk to each other by email, let's say now over the past 8 years or something, probably at least once a week. And I think we've written something like 50 papers together. So the way that the science came about is that she was interested in a variety of things, and it turned out that our skill sets were complementary. Now, I've depended on her very heavily for ideas, and she's dependent on me heavily for logic of expression and various different ways of critiquing the ideas that she has, which are in epidemiologic or medical principles. But I would have to say that she's the leader of the team as far as this kind of work with the pollutants goes.
Let's go back to, it's probably not the beginning because I'm sure I don't really know the beginning, but I'm going back to my beginning in reading your literature, by the way, which is extraordinarily prolific. I want to compliment you just on the volume of extraordinary publications you've authored with her over the last 10 years. It's quite amazing. So talk a little bit about why gamma-glutamyl transpeptidase to begin with. That's some of the first work that showed this association between GGTP elevations in the normal range and health risks. So it sounds like you must have had some presumption, or did that just jump out of the literature unexpectedly?
No, you know, it's been a learning experience for me, and as I said, Ducky is really the person who has motivated the specific scientific ideas. When I first met her, she was dabbling in studies of hypertension and sort of things not being exactly the way you expect them to be. And when she came to Minnesota the first time, which must have been, I don't know, 2002 or 3 or something, she was very interested in oxidative stress. Now, we've had a study on oxidative stress, myself, my colleague Myron Gross at the University of Minnesota, and Michael Steffes again at the University of Minnesota, which is attached to our study, Cardia. That is an NHLBI-funded study that's been going on since 1985, and we're currently following people for their 8th examination. Now, that's been a big part of my life. And we have, as I said, a R01 NIH grant to study oxidative stress. So I had some knowledge of oxidative stress. And Ducky was very interested in the possibility that GGT, and I'll call it GGT rather than GGTP, I'm just used to an older name, that GGT was actually somehow or other involved in oxidative stress and was involved somehow through glutathione. So the function, sort of the biology of GGT, is that it sits on the surface of cells, widely distributed through the body, and it facilitates the breakdown of circulating glutathione, which is 3 proteins, and then the transfer of those components back into the cell. And then the GST, glutathione, is reassembled, and it serves as a primary antioxidant in the intracellular environment. So it seemed as though somehow or other GGT would be important in that. So as we started studying iron, which is a very difficult area because free iron is so fleeting that you almost never see it, or perhaps never actually see it in vivo. But anyway, we went from the iron over to the possibility that GGT might itself be a pro-oxidant or might be somehow or other indicating a very high level of oxidation because of a lot of glutathione activity. And so Ducky did the work on that, the preliminary primary biologic reading. It was very interesting because GDT has primarily been thought of in two respects. One is a marker of alcohol abuse, which is really happening secondary to something like cirrhosis or fatty liver disease caused by high alcohol intake, or liver disease itself. And GDT is then thought of as a liver enzyme. Actually, GDT, as I said, is scattered widely throughout the body, and it has these very important functions in maintaining one of the most important body systems, namely the intracellular antioxidant or oxidative balance. So that was how we got into it, and sure enough, when we started looking at the data really perked up the epidemiologist's eyebrows because it was a very strong finding, and it seemed to go beyond the alcohol idea, and it wasn't just liver, because there were other more specific liver enzymes, ALT and AST, and they didn't behave the same way as GDT. So that's really sort of our first findings and how we got started with that.
For those listening that may not be looking at their recent biochemistry, what I would want to remind you is that when you talk about an amino acid, glutamic acid, that's the G in GGT, that most amino acids are alpha amino acids. So when we put a prefix gamma in front of glutamic acid, gamma-glutamyl, it raises the question, why a funny amino acid like a gamma-linked? And of course, as Dr. Jacobs pointed out, in human biochemistry, the only place that you have prevalence of gamma-glutamic acid is in that tripeptide called glutathione. So what I think was a very skillful perception that Ducky came up with, because it seems that, having been a clinical biochemist for 30 years, that there's always been this presumption that GGT is just shed from a damaged liver, just like ALT and AST, but in this case, alcohol and drug abuse relationship. And now suddenly we start talking about the functional nature of that enzyme, GGTP, gamma-glutamyl, and its connection to glutathione. I think that was a really brilliant connection. And then you go to your epidemiological evaluation of NHANES. So can you tell us a little bit about that? And how did you come up with the POPs concept to start looking at the correlation between persistent organic pollutants and levels in the serum of GGT?
Right. I really appreciated that addition about the amino acids. There's another issue just before I get to the POPs. When we measure just about anything in the blood, I mean, even if we measure things in hair, toenails, whatever, urine, we're looking for the lost penny in the best light. It's hard to get to the cell surface and measure GGT or anything else. Soluble ICAM is another great example that we're working with a lot. And it's hard to get it in its natural environment where it's really working. So what we're working with is the circulating element. And why is it circulating? You know, it should be sitting on the cell surface doing its job. But nevertheless, I really do agree that Ducky Lee is just brilliant, and this was an amazing connection to make. And it's been so much fun for me to watch it work and then look at the epidemiology. Well, she was sitting around in her office in South Korea and thinking about GGT. We had another study which was prominent in this thought process, and that was that she was the biostatistician, epidemiologist, physician working with a company, a steel worker company called Tosco in South Korea. And so they had 8 years of observations, and it included GGT. I think it was between 96 and 2003, something like that. And what we showed was about 180% increase in GGT graded over time and independent of age during that time period. So the mean level of GGT in the beginning of the period was about 8, and I think it went up to a mean of about 25. Those are activity units for the enzyme. And this was really surprising. At the same time in Korea, in the same people, the serum cholesterol went up by about 8%. The GGT was really changing fast. And she was wondering now, what could it be that would cause such a rapid change and such a profound change over time? And she was looking at various different delivery sources of some kind of a provocateur for this. And she finally came to, it must be in the diet. It has to be something that was changing rapidly and that was very commonly eaten or commonly exposed, so everybody in the population would get a fair exposure. She thought, though, that it probably was not the food itself, because the records on that seem to indicate coffee, meat, and fruit as the main factors that affect GGT. So it just didn't seem as though it could be the food itself. And the other thing which might have changed a great deal was these pesticides and other industrial chemicals, especially the ones that were persistent. Now, persistency in a chemical like this, so we'll take a PCB, polychlorinated biphenyl or something. The abbreviations are easier to remember than the long words. Or organochlorine pesticides, so, which have now all been banned since the late 1970s. And among this group also is dioxin. So this dioxin is the most famous of them and was used in Agent Orange to defoliate Vietnam, which is another unfortunate story. In any case, these things enter into the body and then they sit there. They're difficult to metabolize. They're difficult to clear. They probably cause oxidative stress. They probably cause hormone disruption, but they just sit there, especially in fat tissue, and their half-life may be on the order of 10 years or more. So Ducky had done independent reading about those things, and she thought that they might somehow or other be connected to the GGT story. So she's very good at going back to the basic biochemistry textbooks and trying to understand the way that things work far better than I am or will be. And so she drew a picture of another action of GGT, and that is in forming conjugates of xenobiotics with glutathione. And it turns out that within the cell, in that particular reaction where you have some kind of a xenobiotic and glutathione, you have glutathione S-transferase, which is a really important constituent of this whole antioxidant system. And GGT plays an important role, again, in disassembling the glutathione so that it can be conjugated with whatever xenobiotic it is. The xenobiotic conjugate then becomes water-soluble and can be excreted in the urine. Now, whether it would be the POPs themselves that would be so conjugated, which seems less likely, or they wouldn't be persistent, or, say, the reactive oxygen species, which are developed because the POPs are sitting there and the body's complaining about it and trying to react to it, it sort of doesn't matter. So we finally came to the theory, after several years of working with this, that the GGT is actually working not only as a marker of oxidative stress, but more specifically as a marker of the activity and the attempts of the body to clear some of these xenobiotics.
This, to me, is such an amazing representation of discovery. This whole process as to how you two collaborated along this path is fascinating, because it takes us into the next chapter. Maybe it's not the next chapter in your lineage, but in my thinking, it's the next chapter, and that's the connection between obesity and type 2 diabetes. And if there is anything that had rocked perceptions of the origin or the relationship between type 2 diabetes and obesity, it would be your sieving of the epidemiological evidence from Haines and looking at that connection and finding, I believe, that it was not a strong connection in the absence of a marginal elevation within normal range of GGT. So can you tell us about that next step? Because this is just a fascinating journey into discovery.
Well, at least in our preliminary cross-sectional study of N. Haines, we had 2,000 or more people, and I think we had 218 cases of diabetes that were prevalent. In other words, they were existed at the time of measurement of the different POPs, call them POPs for persistent organic pollutants. And there were 463. I'm quoting these numbers by memory, so they may not be exactly right. But I think there were 463 people in the lowest quartile of the POPs. We actually took six POPs and we put them together statistically. And when I say the quartile of the POPs, that means that these were the people who had the least exposure to some combination of these six POPs, which each of which had a pretty powerful relationship with the diabetes. And among those 463 people, about one-third of them were obese, so a BMI, body mass index, over 30. And there were only two cases of diabetes in those 463 people. One of them was in the middle BMI grouping, the 25 to 30 group, and the 30-plus also had one. But that was a 0.5% of the people who had diabetes. And overall, 218 people over about 2,000, it was about 10%. So in the top three quartiles, actually, I think we had 13% versus 0.5% in the bottom quartile of the POPs. Well, that was, as Jeff just said, there was no gradient of the diabetes and within that particular group of people who did not have very much in the way of POPs. Obesity has always been a difficult and interesting thing to understand. The history of obesity and total mortality is strong U-shape. And the history, even with cardiovascular disease, is sometimes on, sometimes off, depending on the data set. And in particular, for many years in the beginning of my career, we really thought that obesity was not a factor, because if you regressed, say, cardiovascular disease on obesity and the triad of blood pressure, smoking, and cholesterol, sort of a Framingham score, the obesity would drop out of the model. Well, then people over the years got a little more sophisticated, and they started to think that there are these secondary paths. So obesity causes hypertension, obesity causes hyperlipidemia. It's related to smoking in that the smokers are thinner, and when they quit smoking, they tend to gain quite a bit of weight. So it's really, in a certain way, a marker of all these things. So it's an indirect player, and similarly, perhaps, with diabetes. But the third line of thought was that the obesity, sometimes it was leading to hypertension and hyperlipidemia, and sometimes it was not. So it's a little hard to know. And now, with this added concept, that there's two added concepts which are really important with obesity. One is that adipose tissue is not only adipose cells. The adipose tissue also contains adipose cells that have died. And those will then be quickly surrounded by macrophages, a similar mechanism for body defense as happens in atherosclerosis. The macrophage colony will be throwing off IL-6, interleukin-6, and a variety of other cytokines. And so actually the adipose tissue is pretty interesting because it's more than just the adipocytes and the fat storage. It's also a storage of some decaying and inflammatory matter. The other thing is that there's lots and lots of fat-soluble substances that we encounter, and so where are they going to sit? Well, besides the fat in the adipocytes, there's going to be fat-soluble substances, and the pollutants that we've been talking about are basically fat-soluble. So there's a lot of reasons for thinking that sometimes funny things are going to happen with obesity. I'm not a proponent of obesity, but I'm a little more skeptical, perhaps, having done some of this work. If people are actually bearing POPs in their fat tissue, there may be a penalty for losing weight. It would be better to be thinner to begin with, to be lean all the way through your life, but if you do get heavier, maybe there's some penalty phase that you have to go through as you're losing, and you would actually then be releasing these fat-soluble substances.
So for the clinician, as they start to make this kind of aha connection between the potential, let's call it surrogate biomarker, of this relationship between xenobiotic accumulation and physiological function, it seemed that your work would point us towards the direction of looking at what is the normal range, because the elevation of these GGT levels that were associated with increasing risk of type 2 diabetes were within the upper quartile, I think, of normal. So what is normal range, and what does it really mean?
You have to be careful with GGT, because as any lab measure, it has its range and its laboratory-specific values. So cholesterol, for example, is extraordinarily well standardized across virtually every lab in the U.S., but there are different tests for GGT in different ranges. So absolute numbers are a little bit difficult, although I was citing some earlier. But people typically talk about values such as 40 for women and 50 for men as being the end of the normal range. If you send a participant in a research study to a physician with a GGT of 60, they're going to say, I don't really know what to do with this. It's got to be 2-3 times the upper limit of normal. And then they're going to be thinking of treating liver disease. So they'll be doing other liver tests and that kind of thing. Well, what should you do with all this stuff in the normal range? And I think that in many ways, this research points to the connectedness of life and the connectedness of the organs within the body equally well. So when I say connectedness of life, we really enjoy the flame retardants, which are brominated chemicals, much like the chlorinated ones that we've been dealing with. And we enjoy the ease of eradicating mosquitoes, which might carry malaria. We enjoy the PCBs in our computers. We're so dependent on all of these things. The oil spill in the Gulf, it's directly related to all of this and how industrial we are. But it's not without a penalty. It's not without its risks. And one of the risks is that the chemicals that we use are not necessarily compatible with life. We should be suspicious when we use a pesticide. We have a chemical that is noxious to one form of life, that it also is going to have some kind or other of subtle damage to humans. So if we're going to put humans in a special place, let's not forget that we're life forms and we have a lot in common with bacteria, for example, in that way. So this connectedness of life, we really have to be careful politically and socially about what we do. And it's not so much, although maybe the physicians can be raising a hue and cry about this and saying, look, we have to be really careful about the way that we develop the technology and the way we use things. We do like our nice cozy lives, but we'd better be careful about how we're doing things. I mean, I don't know a medical solution to this. As far as the connectedness of organs, well, we were thinking liver, but what about the kidney and what about the blood vessels and what is it exactly that insulin resistance is, and where's the defect? Is it just in the pancreas or in the insulin receptors throughout the body, and so on and so on? I'm not so sure what to say for the clinician. One thing I should mention, I think maybe we're running short on time at this point, but I want to mention that in our studies of GGT, it has not been as predictive and maybe even not predictive, say, of cardiovascular disease and diabetes in the elderly. So once you get above 65 or 70 years old, the GGT seems to stop with its very powerful predictive capacity. Now, Duckey's idea about this, not well substantiated, but she has a pretty good history of making really clever guesses. Her idea is that as we age, we lose the capacity for good phase 2 enzyme systems and the clearing of xenobiotics and that sort of thing. And maybe that's the case. So clinically, the GGT might be very helpful if you have a sort of standard measurement scale and you have a 40-year-old person and that person comes in with, say, a 45 or a 50 GGT. That might be something that you should be thinking about as a warning sign that this person may be on a path towards diabetes or towards hypertension or towards heart disease. If you saw the same thing in a 70-year-old person, maybe you would not even say, why am I measuring this thing? It's not really relevant. That would be sort of the current status I think, of the way that a clinician might use GGT.
So let me, if I can, given in the, just a few minutes we have remaining, ask a combination question. The scope of your involvement in looking at the field in a broader sense has been very, very large. Recently, you were one of the authors on a paper, along with Dr. Lee, that looked at the association between certain genotypes that are associated with type 2 diabetes and how that might relate ultimately even into ethnic risks, the GWAS studies and type 2 diabetes, and is there any ethnic difference looking at Korean versus Caucasians? Do you feel that there are ethnic specificities of relative risk from what you've seen so far? In other words, certain individuals might have a higher susceptibility?
Mostly I think that the differences among human beings are trivial compared to, say, the differences between our neighbors, bonobo apes and chimpanzees. And we're, as a human species, we're pretty alike. Nevertheless, when you look at the genetic information, you see lots and lots of single nucleotide polymorphisms that vary depending upon who you mate with. I like the term mating pool better than race, actually. So there are some differences, and I think that they're mostly overblown. Now, one of the interesting differences, though, is obesity in its relation to diabetes in Asians versus Caucasians. And it seems as though at a level or a body size that would not look particularly fat to us, the Asians are already developing diabetes at a much higher rate than we are. So far, the Asians have not been getting the level of obesity that we have in the West. But that does seem to be a difference. Now, could that have something to do with the POPs? I mean, that is very difficult to know. Ducky has been starting to do some of these studies in Koreans, but the POPs take 2 or more mLs of blood, which is a huge amount in the world of cohort studies that I live in. We save 0.5 mL vials, so sort of the money in the bank for these cohort studies is the vials, the blood vials that are in the blood bank, and who wants to give up 4 of them to measure POPs? And then the other problem is that you need very specialized equipment. It's a tandem mass spectrometry to measure the POPs, and it's like at least $300 a shot to measure these things. So it makes them rather difficult to study, and we're kind of waiting for the field to catch fire where people reserve special aliquots and they say, yes, this is important enough to do it, and maybe other breakthroughs are made in analytic methods so we can study them. But they're in very low concentrations. That itself is a big warning. I mean, that they could be apparently causing quite a bit of damage at very low concentrations.
Good. So let me ask one last follow-on question of the myriad of questions that we could go on to discuss. But you have also been very actively involved in looking at the relationship between whole grains versus refined grains in things like cardiovascular disease. Do you think there's any connection that you've seen in your work that might correlate dietary persuasions of whole versus refined grain diets, POPs, and diabetes? In other words, these diet persuasions, could they also translate into relative risk of exposure or something related to metabolism of these POPs, putting people at higher risk with increasing GGTs?
Well, I said earlier that POPs are delivered through food, and I didn't really emphasize that very much, but they're in the fatty tissues, and since they're persistent, when an organism is slaughtered or is carrying pesticides as a plant for us to eat, that is still there, and the fat perpetuates itself through the ecologic cycle. So that means, if POPs are delivered through food, even though they've already been banned, and they're stuck in the food supply, that really messes up nutritional epidemiology. Because we used to think that nutritional epidemiology could be done with a table of nutrients, a list of food names, and you would know an apple is an apple, a piece of pork is a piece of pork, and you could study what you were eating. But now, with the recognition that pops are in the food supply, and mercury and heavy metals are another really good example of the same kind of thing, or bisphenol A is another one that we're getting through plastic, so it's in the containers that our food is contained in. It makes it very hard to know exactly what you're getting when you eat a food. So having said that about this sort of unfortunate disjuncture between POPs and nutrition, the work that I've done with whole grains led me in another direction, and that is to the concept of nutrient-rich plant foods in general. Because I was trying to think, what could it be about the whole grains that in study after study, independent of who was looking at it, independent of the nature of the population, the people who were eating whole grains were having a lower risk. So of course, it turns out that whole grain consumption, so the act of going out and looking for the whole wheat bread or eating the oatmeal, or not eating the breakfast cereals that are made with refined grain, looking for brown rice, that kind of thing, it indicated a person with a high level of health consciousness. So you see all the popular behaviors that if you would say to me or say to any random scientist, well, what's good for you? And the people who are eating whole grains are also, for example, taking vitamin supplements. Now, I don't think vitamin supplements is a good idea at all, but popularly it's believed that they are. So they are also better educated. The women are taking hormone replacement, which is another thing which in the past years has been questions raised about it, but say in the 1980s it was strongly believed that that was a good thing to do. They're more physically active. They're less smokers. So is it really the whole grains? Well, I think it is the whole grains. I think it has to do with this rich layer of bioactive substances that the plant uses for its own survival, which is sitting on the outer layers, the alurone layer, which is right under the bran in the grain. And I think more generally that you have many of the same kinds of substances and you have the same idea of botanical benefit should translate into human consumption benefit. So there's lots and lots of plant foods that work like that. Now, among those plant foods is not sugar. Now, why not sugar? Well, there's nothing wrong with sugar in a plum, for example, because that comes with everything else in the plum, and so it's been naturally organized by evolution for the virtue of the plum and the plum tree's survival. That sugar is probably great, the same as everything else that comes with the plum. But the sugar which is just poured in great mounds into water and then served up as sugar-sweetened beverages provides a lot of calories, but it provides none of these other nutrients that you would get. Now, the same thing would hold for refined grains, because you've laboriously gone through and chopped off all the good stuff, and you're left with the starch, which is not in itself bad, but it's not in its natural proportion, and it's missing an opportunity, I say, to maximize nutrients per bite. So it's missing the opportunity to actually give the person a bunch of extra nutrients. And then another bad category would be something like French fries, where the cooking method is such that you are oxidizing the oil. You just heat it and heat it and heat it, and you get changes in the chemistry of the oil, and then those changes are not necessarily so good. The margarine thing was another example of this preparation thing. It's kind of akin to the pollution chemicals in that we wanted to have margarine. We thought the saturated fat was bad for us, so we engineered something so we would still have the nice solid feel of butter, but, you know, it would be all vegetable oil. Unfortunately, the hydrogenation doesn't occur to any extent in nature, and we had a whole lot of isolated trans fats, which become everybody's whipping boy these days. So those are a few of the principles of nutrition that I've been thinking about in the last couple of years, and actually doing all of that work in connection with the work on POPs has been a very illuminating and mind-opening thought process.
Yeah, I think you said that beautifully, and I'm struck as I listen to you thinking about all of the various secondary metabolites in plants and whole grains that modulate gene expression associated with these enzymes that you discussed earlier that have phase 2 detoxification effect, quinone reductase, glutathione S-transferase, and so forth. So this web that you described, this interconnectedness as systems of biology, really argues for all of these variables you've been describing having some interesting symphonic orchestrated relationship. And I think that's a whole different view of the biology of life than probably many of us grew up with in our training, which was more compartmentalized, isolated, insular, and reductionistic. So I want to compliment you. This work you're doing is just very, very pioneering. I know any good work, as it answers questions, it opens up new questions, but that's how fields evolve. And I think you've left us with extraordinarily provocative and important questions related to how we proceed. So thank you, Dr. Jacobs, very, very much, and continue the great work. We're going to follow it very closely.
Well, thank you so much for all those nice remarks, and I think that your final remarks about this systems biology were also beautifully stated.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Well, I'm hopeful that as you've heard Dr. Jacobs' story told by him and have had a chance to kind of let this process over your frontal lobes, that you'll recognize that this is not an esoteric topic. This is a very important clinical topic with important clinical outcome potentials. And when we tie that together with what we're going to be discussing in the September issue with Dr. Randy Journal, it frames a whole new step forward in the evolution of functional medicine.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis, LLC, by Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.